this is, of course, place where I usually say something to the effect of turn with me, if you will, to the place where this week's Torah portion begins, which is the book of Leviticus, or Vayikra, chapter 21 in this case, and it's right at the beginning of chapter 21. And as so many of these do, it begins with either Yahuwah spoke to Moshe and he said, or something to that effect. And in this case, it says this, "And Yahuwah said unto Moshe, Emor, speak unto the priests, the Kohanim in the Hebrew, the sons of Aaron." Now remember, the sons of Aaron are the specifics that are the priesthood. And is this redundant? Well, it's, remember, the Levites is a bigger group, so it does sound a bit redundant. But in any case, there are priests that aren't sons of Aaron, of course, too. So there's the key. "Say to them, no one shall defile themselves for the dead among his people." Now, this is something we've heard, but we just talked about it last week as far as the Parsha to be Kedoshim, set apart. There is an exception, though, in this case. It says, "No one shall defile himself for the dead among his people except for his kin." His near kin in particular. That would mean his mother, his father, his son or his daughter, or his brother. Or for his sister, provided she is still betula, a virgin that's near unto him. In other words, one that is not married. For those, or for her, he may defile himself. Now, defile himself is perhaps an unfortunate choice of the English word here, but basically he becomes unclean in contact with the dead. And the priest is not normally supposed to do that, obviously, with the exception of near kin. "He shall not defile himself, being a chief man among his people, to profane himself." Now, here is a bit of a repetition, not quite word for word, but similar to what we also saw last week. These folks, the Kohanim, may not make baldness upon their head. I'm assuming that for those of us that it happens naturally, or at least in places, that's a different story. "Not to cut off your hair to shave bald spots on your head, nor shall they shave off the corners of their beard, nor make any cuttings in their flesh," which was a pagan practice, and it's one that's still, as we talked about also last week, fairly widespread, almost epidemic. "They shall, in fact, be kedoshim." There's the plural, kedosh. "They all shall be kedosh." Kedoshim, in plural, "unto their Elohim. They shall not profane the name of their El, for the various offerings, the ones made by fire, the bread of their their El, they do offer, therefore they need to be set apart." And furthermore, now we're going to get a list of restrictions on the kinds of women that a priest can take as a wife. And the standards here are higher. Ordinary men that aren't part of the priesthood can take a wife that is divorced, but not the case here. They're not to take a woman that is a harlot or is profaned, nor shall they take a woman who has been put away. And that word there is the shalach word. But in this case, understand, obviously you couldn't take a woman that was merely put away that didn't have a get anyway. So the understanding has to be this is a woman who is available for remarriage to others other than a Kohen. In other words, she has a get, but even in this case, that's not enough. He is to be set apart. "They shall therefore sanctify him. He offers the bread of Yahuwah. He needs to be holy unto you, for I, Yahuwah, who sanctifies you, am set apart." Now, furthermore, if there's a daughter of a priest that profanes herself by playing the harlot, she not only profanes her father, she ends up to be burnt with fire. Now, interestingly, the only place that I can think of that we see this reference, and it dates all the way back to the book of Genesis, prior to the time, and ironically, it's what Judah wants to do with Tamar, when he finds out that she allegedly had played the harlot, let her be burned. Now, of course, in this case, he is not yet, he's not of the line of kings at this point yet. Certainly there aren't these kinds of priests either. But it does seem like somehow or other an implication predates this commandment in the Torah. "The priest that's highest among his brethren, among whose head the anointing oil is poured, he's the one that's consecrated to put on the garments. He shall not let the hair of his head go loose nor rend his clothes. He's not to go near a dead body, nor to defile himself for his father or his mother." So the high priest, the anointed one, has even a higher standard still. "He's not to go out of the sanctuary nor profane the sanctuary of his God, for the consecration of the anointing oil of Yahuwah is upon him, ani Yahuwah." And he shall, in fact, as we've already talked about, take a wife in her virginity. Repetition here, but that makes the point. A widow, one who has been put away and given a get, or a profane woman, or a harlot, all of these are off limits to him. He is to take a virgin of his own people to wife. And that seems to have an implication that literally she needs to be of the tribe of Levi. He shall not profane his seed among his people, for ani Yahuwah who sanctifies him. And Yahuwah wasn't done yet. He then said, speak to Aaron in particular. Tell him, whosoever he be of your seed throughout the generations that has a blemish, he is not to approach to offer the bread of his El. Now, this is another one. My margin notes, I remind myself, Kohanim Disability Act. Okay? This is very politically incorrect. It's not one of a number of things. On the other hand, you got to remember, it's the Creator who establishes the standards. And what he is saying here is that a man who is less than physically, I wouldn't say completely perfect in the English sense, but if he has an obvious blemish, he is not to approach and to do these things. He's not to be blind or lame or anyone that has anything maimed or anything too long or a man that's broken-footed or broken-handed or crook-backed or a dwarf or that has his eyes overspread or scabbed or scurvy or has his stones crushed. He needs to be functional. No man of the seed of Aaron the priest that has a blemish shall come nigh to offer the offerings of Yahuwah made by fire. He's a blemish. He simply isn't going to be allowed to do that. He can eat the bread of Elohim, both of the most holy and of the holy. So he's not a castaway. He's not completely cast out. There are simply things that the Creator says he is not going to do. He shall not go in under the veil nor come nigh the altar because he has a blemish, so that he does not profane my holy places, for I am Yahuwah who sanctifies them. Okay, got a question from Jay. Wife that has been put out of her home, but husband refuses to give her a get. Can she remarry? And that's a long discussion. And it's one of those things that has been a subject of much consternation. What Scripture says explicitly is, if he puts her away, he shallocks her, he sends her out. If he doesn't give her a get, she still has a husband. Now, the problem is, during the time of Yeshua, and he was very condemning of men that refused to do this, that literally were keeping their wives on a hook, but not providing for them. What he said is that if she goes out and commits adultery, you're the one that I'm going to hold responsible. That's in Matthew 5, the section there. But on the other hand, because that's often what would happen. And he says, you are the one that's committing adultery. But he also says the following, that if the woman goes out and does not have a get, then she is not able to remarry because she is still married. So yes, anyone else that takes her is in fact committing adultery. And I'm trying to think of the Hebrew word. The aguna problem, it's called an aguna. This is a woman that's in that situation. Famously, and I know we've talked about this before, one of the times that you'd see this happen would be a woman whose husband went off to war and simply didn't show up. He was MIA. Okay, is he dead or is he alive? And up until the point where it was determined that he was dead, they found a body or whatever, she was still married and was unable to remarry. So it became a practice oftentimes that a man going off to war would give his wife a get and trust her just in case he didn't come back so that she wouldn't be in that unfortunate situation. But that's a problem, and it's been the subject, as you might suspect, of much discussion and consternation for centuries. But in this case, it's a different situation for the priest. He is not to take such a woman anyway. All right, back to the Kohanim Disability Act. The man who has any of those list of blemishes is not to go in under the veil, come nigh the altar. So, moving on, Moshe spoke to Aaron and to his sons and to all the children of Israel, and he then said the following. speak unto Aaron and his sons, tell them that they separate themselves from the holy things of the children of Israel, which they hallow unto me, and they do not profane my set-apart name, Ani Yahuwah. Say to them, whosoever of your seed, all your seed throughout your generations, that approaches unto the set-apart things, the holy things, the things that are kadosh, which the children of Israel hallow unto Yahuwah, having his uncleanness upon him, that soul is to be cut off, Ani Yahuwah. So understand this. It is important. And you see this, by the way, this is one of the understood elements even of the story of the Good Samaritan. That he is, this is a Kohen, and he is not to approach unto somebody that he doesn't know that might not be unclean and so forth, because it is serious. And that kind of helps to set the tone for that parable when you go through and read it. If you understand that the Kohen was supposed to be set apart, so he was very careful if he was heading, especially towards his time to do temple duty, not to be profaned, not to be in the vicinity of a dead body or all those other things that would cause him to be unclean. Whenever there's a man of the seed of Aaron who's a leper, he has an issue. He is not able to eat of the set-apart things until he is clean. Anyone that touches anyone who's unclean by the dead or from whom the seed goes out, in other words, he has an emission, a seminal emission, whether it's through sexual congress with his wife or at night or something, or someone who touches a swarming thing, or any of those things would make him unclean. That soul that touches anything unclean shall be unclean till the evening, not eat of the holy things until and unless he bathes his flesh in water. Now, once the sun is down, he shall be clean. Afterwards, he can go back and eat the holy things. That's his rightful bread. It also says, anything which dies of itself or is torn of beasts, he shall not eat to defile himself therewith. Ani Yahuwah. Keep my charge, lest they bear sin for it and die therein. If they profane it, I am Yahuwah who sets them apart, who sanctifies them, who makes them, literally, kedoshim. No common person, one who's not a Kohen, in other words, shall eat of a set-apart thing. Not a tenant of a priest or a hired servant, none of them shall eat. Now, on the other hand, if the priest has a hired servant or a purchased bond servant, he may eat. Such are born in his own house. They too may eat of the bread which is rightfully his. A priest's daughter, okay? Now, while she is living in the priest's house, she, of course, is able to eat of these things. But if she marries a common man, one who's not a Kohen, she shall not eat of the things which are set apart from the holy things anymore. But at the point where she becomes a widow, or if she has a get, she gets divorced and doesn't have a child. Now, if she does, it's a different story. But if she has a child, then she can return to her father's house, just like it was in her youth. And again, she can eat of her father's bread. But it repeats it, no common man. And if a man does manage to eat of the holy things through error, well, he does literally what you do, at least relatively similar to what you do with a theft. He adds a fifth part thereto unto it and gives the priest the holy thing. Do not profane the holy things of the children of Israel, which are set apart unto Yahuwah, so as to cause them to bear iniquity and bring guilt when they eat their set apart things, for Ani Yahuwah who sanctifies them. Now, at this point, I want to pause, and I'm gonna make a comment that applies to the rest of the portion, and especially to this part that we've just finished doing. And I said up front, we have a lot of things in here that are politically incorrect. And we also have a lot of things in here that, of course, we're told, that doesn't matter anymore. That's Old Testament stuff. That's all done away with stuff. And what we're going to see as I go through the next few sections is that is not true. It's another one of those lies we've inherited from our fathers. Now, what is true is that while we may have enough technology today to be able to identify the gene, the Kohenim gene, that a lot of people actually carry in their DNA, so there is that element. Prior to the last, couple of decades at the most, before the gene was identified, there was no way to tell for sure who was a Kohen or not. Now, among people that are of clearly Judaic heritage, you have certain names that kind of imply it. Well, like the name Cohen. There's a fairly obvious one. There's a lot of Cohens, lots of variations on the name Cohen that you'll see. You'll also see people that have names like Levi or Levin, which is a of the family of Levi. Doesn't necessarily mean they're a Cohen, although some of them might be. But notwithstanding that, essentially, we don't really know who the Kohanim were. Even at the time of Yeshua, you had a bunch of imposters that had bought their way in that weren't genuine Kohanim. So it was problematic even then as to, you know, who was literally able to do these things. They had people that weren't, the high priest at the time, not officially able to even fill the job. But hey, come to think of it, we've had presidents that would fall into that category, so it shouldn't surprise us, right? The point is that there are a number of reasons, even though these things haven't been done away with, why they still can't be done. Obvious one, of course, is that there isn't a temple or a mishkan or a place for these things to do. The place where he put his name and said that these offerings were to be brought. Well, it doesn't exist anymore, so it's a moot point. But it's still important, I will contend, that we understand what he says about these things for a whole lot of reasons. People say, oh, well, I am a priest and a king according to the line of Melchizedek. Well, then, are there indications? Are there things that would apply in Scripture that would be worth understanding if you make that claim? And so forth. All right, it says in verse 18 here of this middle chapter, speak unto Aaron and his sons and all the children of Israel. So this is now a broader understanding. Say to them, whosoever he be of the house of Israel or of the strangers in Israel that brings his offering, whether it's, there are a number of ways that he could bring offerings, right? It could be of his vows, free will offerings, burnt offerings, things that they would bring to him, that it may be accepted, you're to offer the following. A male without blemish can be of the beeves, or of the sheep, or of the goats. But don't bring something that has a blemish. It's not acceptable for you. If you bring a sacrifice of shalamim, of peace offerings unto Yahuwah, in fulfillment of a vow clearly uttered, or just because you want to for a free will offering, or if it's of the herd or of the flock, it needs to be perfect. It needs to be blemish-free. Blind, broken, or maimed, and now it's going to make sure that we understand what that means, or having a wen or a scabs or scurvy, don't offer these unto Yahuwah, nor make an offering by fire of them upon the altar of Yahuwah. Now you can imagine that this is the kind of commandment that makes a whole lot of sense. To the extent that if somebody is saying, okay, well, I got a flock of a bunch of sheep here. There, that one that's on the wobbly leg, that's blind in one eye, and that's had his stones smashed when he ran into off the mountain. Let's just sacrifice that one. And the answer is no. It's not a sacrifice. It's not acceptable. A bull or a lamb that has anything that's too long or too short, you can offer that for a free will offering. But it will not be accepted for a vow. And then he goes on, that which has its stones bruised or crushed or torn or cut, do not offer unto Yahuwah. You shall not do this in your land. Now, as I was reading this, we have new kids, and you always have the question with new kids, do you want to castrate them or not? And I guess in terms of, it's to the extent that we're not able to make these offerings, again, doesn't matter. But I remember at least raising an eyebrow and thinking about this in a different way as I was reading through it this week. Now, from the hand of a foreigner shall you offer the bread of Yahuwah of any of these, because there's corruption in them. There is a blemish in them. They're not acceptable for you. Now, then Yahuwah spoke to Moshe and he said the following, when a bull or a sheep or a goat is brought forth, it is to be 7 days under the dam. In other words, minimum time. You got a new blessing has been delivered. A bull or a sheep or a goat. And it's to be with this mother for 7 days. After the 8th day, it becomes an acceptable offering made by fire unto Yahuwah. Whether it's a cow or a ewe, you're not to kill it, and it's young, both in one day. And when you sacrifice a sacrifice of thanksgiving to Yahuwah, you shall sacrifice it so that it's accepted. On the same day that it's sacrificed, it needs to be eaten. Don't leave it until the morning, and we've heard that before too, Ani Yahuwah. You shall keep my commandments and do them. Ki Ani Yahuwah, for I am Yahuwah. Do not profane my set apart name, but I will be hallowed among the children of Israel. Ani Yahuwah, who hallows you. And that word is Me Kodeshkem. There it is, same root, right? I make you, plural, Kodesh. Because I brought you up out of the land of Egypt to be your Elohim, Ani Yahuwah. There's a pattern here that when I see this, I always want to make sure I emphasize it over and over again in here. Just like we saw in Leviticus, he signs some of these with his signature line, Ki Ani Yahuwah, or I am Yod-Heh Vav-Heh. Sometimes it's I am Yod-Heh Vav-Heh Eloheka, your El, or the equivalent. But it's making the point. This is important. And we're going to see some other things in here too. Chapter 23. Yahuwah spoke to Moshe and he said the following. Speak unto, okay, this is broader than just the Kohanim. Speak unto the B'nai Israel, the children of Israel, say to them, the appointed seasons of Yahuwah, which you shall proclaim to be holy, set apart convocations. That word holy, again, Kadesh. Even these are my appointed seasons. All right, he emphasizes it. I try to, because it appears this way over and over again. I can't tell you how many times I grew up and I've heard, and it really still bothers me. Oh, you know, we don't keep those Jewish feasts. Well, let me be blunt here. Why the hell not? A, they're not Jewish. I got no problem with the fact that the Jews who are observant want to keep them. Great. But they're not their feasts. They don't belong to one tribe alone. They're his, Moedim. He says it, and here he says it again. He says it many times. But if you look at this verse and the way it's phrased, it's kind of fascinating. All right, the beginning part, speak unto the children of Israel, tell them the following. Here comes the quote. The appointed seasons, and the word there is the Moedim, right, plural, Moed, a holy day, a set-apart day, Moedim, plural. And here they are Moedi. They're mine, he says. They are of Yahuwah. So let's be clear on that. These are his feasts. And he even says that. You shall proclaim them to be set apart convocations. Even these are my appointed times. They're Moedi. They're mine. Don't be saying they're somebody else's or that they're done away with or any of that kind of BS. They're mine. And then we're going to get a listing of them and a description of some of the specifics that are important about them. 6 days shall... Ooh, have we heard this one before? This must be important. It's usually the first way he starts off with this, and we've already seen it several times throughout the Torah. 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of solemn rest, a holy convocation. You shall do no manner of work. It is a Sabbath unto Yahuwah in all your dwellings. Now notice, on this particular Sabbath, it says, do no manner of work. As we go through some of these other Moedim, we're going to see different phrasing. And it's in the differences that we kind of get an understanding of some of the nuances here. Again, in verse 4, it says, these are Moedi Yahuwah, the appointed seasons of Yahuwah, set apart, holy, kadosh, convocations, which you shall proclaim in their appointed season. Who is Moshe talking to? Answer. Remember? All of the children of Israel. Do we want to be grafted in? I hope so. If so, we are to proclaim them in their appointed season. Here comes the list. There's actually 7 in total. And if you think about it, it's 2 sets of 3 plus the Sabbath, right? So you have the 3 spring feasts, the 3 fall feasts are kind of the way to remember it. And we are now going to talk about the first of the spring feast. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, at dusk, is the Passover of what? The Jews? No, Yahuwah. The 15th day of the same month, next day, is the Feast of Unleavened Bread unto Yahuwah. And you are to eat unleavened bread for 7 days. Well, we just did that not too long ago. First day is to be a set apart, a Kodesh, a holy convocation. Do no manner of servile work. Huh. Now, notice, on the Sabbath day, it says no manner of work, period. Just don't do any work. And other places, we get an understanding of what that is. As I have pointed out, if you go to the rabbis and the additions to, you'll find they have added all kinds of things which may or may not be appropriate. But the one thing that's clear is they're forbidden from adding to or subtracting from. So I will contend that to add to and claim thus spoke Yahuwah when he did not speak is a problem. Now, do I believe that individuals need to make their own choices? Absolutely. For somebody to say, okay, well, I think the rabbis make a good case and I choose to walk that way, fine. Great. But there's a difference between saying, this is what I'm going to do for me and my house, and saying, you must do likewise. Thus spoke Yahuwah, when in fact he didn't. So I will always try to be as careful as I can to suggest to folks, hey, you know, head of house, for you and your house, you make the halaha, you make the walk. For those that say, okay, well, I'm going to obey what the rabbis say, whether I like it or not, all right, well, that's your choice too. Fine. Where I have a problem is when people add to and say, thus spoke Yahuwah, again, when he did not thus speak. What he speaks, though, is right here. So what we're told are some of the specifics, and here we go. First day you have a holy convocation, do no manner of servile work. All right, well, what is servile work? Somehow or other, that does seem to be different. I think one of the things that I would suggest is fairly obvious is you don't go and draw a paycheck doing the same kind of work that you do every other day of the year in exchange for filthy lucre or whatever you want to call it. So that part, I would say, seems fairly obvious. One of the traditional understandings is that, and it even actually says this in Scripture, so the tradition is based on the written word, which is just great. It says that, when it comes to things that people need to do to eat, you can do that. So you can make food and so forth. A lot of times you'll hear people call these cooking Sabbaths, the Moedim, like the first and last day of Pesach and so forth. You shall bring an offering made by fire unto Yahuwah 7 days. In the seventh day, it's a set-apart convocation. Do no manner of servile work. So the first and last days, first and seventh days, this servile work thing applies. Sometimes called Sabbaths. I'm usually careful about that terminology because we don't want to confuse them with the weekly Sabbath. And if you read through the New Testament writings, you'll see that a lot of the people that have translated that didn't have a clue about the difference between the weekly Sabbath and the high Sabbath, if you want to call it that, or the Sabbath associated with the first and last days of Pesach. So there's been all kinds of confusion. And the way I usually explain it is, if you go during the week of Passover, by definition, it lasts 7 days. There will be 1 week in there where there is a day of no work from the Pesach and a day of no work from the Sabbath, too. So there's kind of two Sabbaths during that week, although that's part of the reason why the confusion. Right? Yahuwah then spoke to Moshe. Moving on. He said, speak unto the children of Israel, say to them, when you come into the land which I give you, and you reap the harvest thereof, you shall bring the sheave of the first fruits of your harvest unto the priest. So we're talking about this time that's typically called first fruits. You wave that sheaf, the priest is going to do it, in other words, before Yahuwah to be accepted for you. On the morrow after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. Okay. Let's pause. I won't go into a lot of detail here, but suffice it to say, between the Sadducees and the Pharisees, between the traditional Jews and a lot of us, and I kind of fall into the other camp, Rashi claims, and he makes a reasonable case. I'd say the jury is still out on it, but it's not a convincing enough case in my mind. But Rashi says that that must mean the festival Sabbath, Pesach, not the weekly Sabbath. The Sadducees historically disagreed. So the question is, when you start this count and when you do the Feast of First Fruits and the wave offerings, is that the day after that high Sabbath, if you will, of Passover? Is it the day after the weekly Sabbath that comes that same week? And as you know, since we were talking about counting from the day that would have been the first Sunday, the first Yom Rishon, the first day after that, I conclude that when he says the Sabbath, the morrow after the Sabbath, he's talking about the weekly Sabbath. And again, there's some disagreement there. Your mileage may vary, and I don't break fellowship when people count differently. But whenever we start counting, this is where we're going to count to 50, right? In the day that you wave the sheaf, you shall offer a he-lamb without blemish, first year, for a burnt offering, an olah, unto Yahuwah. the meal offering, and it describes it, 2/10 part of an ephah, fine flour mixed with oil for a sweet savor. A drink offering thereof is wine, 1/4 part of a hin. And you shall eat neither bread nor parched corn nor fresh ears until this selfsame day, until you have brought the offering of your Elohim. Now, here's a key verse. It says here, this is a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings. So if somebody tells me, oh, that's all done away with, I'm going to say, then just who the hell are you calling a liar? And I think it's important to be blunt. He says it is a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwelling places. And I'm thinking, what about that is not clear? Furthermore, remember in Matthew 5, 17 through 19, first words, that he speaks, the Sermon on the Mount, in other words, Yahushua, the Torah made flesh, right up front says, I'm not going to change anything, not changing a single yod nor Torah, nor yod nor tittle of the Torah or the prophets, not the smallest part, long as heaven and earth still exist. So he didn't change it. These things are still appropriate. And you're to count from the morrow after the day of rest, from the day that you brought the sheaf of waving, 7 weeks shall be complete. Even unto the morrow of the 7th week, number 50 days. And at that point, you present a new meal offering unto Yahuwah. Bring out of your dwellings 2 wave loaves, 2/10 part of an ephah, fine flour baked with leaven, this time, for first fruits unto Yahuwah. And present with the bread 7 lambs without blemish, first year, 1 young bull, 2 rams. All of this is a burnt offering, an olah unto Yahuwah, along with the meal offering and the drink offerings, an offering made by fire, a sweet savor. And you offer, furthermore, 1 he-goat for a sin offering, 2 he-lambs of the first year for shalamim, peace offerings. And the priest shall wave them with the bread of the first fruits for a wave offering before Yahuwah, along with the 2 he-lambs. They shall be holy to Yahuwah for the priest. So there's going to be quite a barbecue here. And you shall make proclamation on that same day. This shall be a holy convocation unto you. You shall do no manner of servile work. Let's pause there for just a second. So now we've talked about all 3 of the spring feasts. You have the day of the Passover meal, the first and last days that are set apart of that week. Then you have essentially this time of the wave offerings, the first fruits that's in there. And then now, 50 days later, we have the final of the 3 of the spring feasts, and it's often called Shavuot. Some people will call it Pentecost, for the Greek word for 50, after 50 days. Then when you reap the harvest of your land, and we've heard this before, you don't reap every corner of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of the harvest. Leave that for the poor and for the stranger, Ani Yahuwah. Then he continued. He spoke to Moshe, and he said the following, speak unto the children of Israel, right? Understand who the audience is, saying, all right, remember we've talked about the spring feast. Now how about the fall feast? In the 7th month, first day of the month, this shall be a day of solemn rest unto you, a memorial proclaimed with a blast of horns, a set apart, a holy kadosh convocation. Okay, let's see. A blast of horns, a teruah, literally. So it's often called, Yom Teruah, the day of the blowing of shofars, or the day of shouting, too. You shall do no manner of servile work. Now, that is the kind of the standard prescription for his set-apart Moedim, the ones that the pagans and those that essentially claim that he did away with his own word, because you can't trust him, because he's a liar and the truth is not in him, I guess. Hard not to be sarcastic, folks, when you see him say so many times, this shall be forever in all your generations, all your dwellings. And the whore church says, oh, no, it's all done away with. We got a better feast now, this sun god feast. We got some bunnies and eggs, and we like Christmas trees, and we don't like any of the stuff he said he wants us to do. But again, the common thread here, the first day is a day of no servile work, a holy convocation. Do no manner of servile work. Bring an offering made by fire unto Yahuwah. Now, other places, we're not going to see the descriptions of the offerings. Obviously, we don't have the ability to make the offerings anymore, so quite frankly, don't worry about that part. But I will contend that even though we can't do all of the things, we can memorialize the things, if you want to put it that way. We need to pay attention. And obviously, especially if we look back and say, okay, first time around, the Mashiach seemed to be very careful to fulfill all of the elements of the spring feasts. Literally, as another friend likes to say, to the minute, to the hour, to the day. Or maybe the day, the minute, the day, the hour, and the minute. Anyway, he was exceedingly precise in fulfilling those elements. And still, note, a lot of people missed it. We still got a lot of people that that don't understand the significance of those things. And then how much more so, to use the old Hebrew adage, if they aren't keeping the fall feasts, are they likely to miss the things that we are looking forward to now? I mean, for crying out loud, how can you claim to understand what's coming if you aren't even practicing, memorializing the things he said to do for a very specific reason? Well, arguably several reasons. That would seem to be only one of them. Okay, so then Yahuwah continued, and he said, howbeit, or but. This is a restrictive term, in other words, that first word there. On the 10th day of the 7th month is the day of atonement. Yom Kippur, the day of atonement, the day of covering. We'll talk about that word in a second. There shall be a holy convocation unto you. So this is a set-apart moed as well. And this one, it says, you shall afflict your souls, your nefesh, in plural, your nefeshekim. And you shall bring an offering made by fire unto Yahuwah. Now this time it says, you shall do no manner of work. In that same day. This is a day of atonement, to make atonement for you before Yahuwah your El. Now that word, of course, is Kippurim, atonement there. So this is Yom Kippurim. Kippa, ever heard that term? A little hat? It's a covering. So this is also another way to translate that word that's Kippurim, plural, is a covering. It's a day of covering. And then it says the following. For whatsoever soul it is that in that day shall not be afflicted on that same day, this guy shall be cut off from his people. Now notice with these other ones, we didn't get a stricture. But in this one we are. 10th day, 7th month, important. If you don't do what it says here, whatever it means to afflict your soul, the result is that that person is cut off. And whatever soul it is that does any manner of work in that same day, this is kind of serious sounding. That soul I will destroy from among his people. And just in case there's any doubt, he repeats it again and says the following. You shall do no manner of work. It is a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings. It is unto you to be a Sabbath of solemn rest. You shall afflict your nefshim, your souls, in the 9th day of the month at evening. Now, we're going to get a specific here. In other words, from the time, basically, that the sun goes down on that 9th day of the month, from evening unto evening, 24 hours, you shall keep that Sabbath. And Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, okay, so we're moving on to the next one. I got a question, though, here. It says, which offering was bought in verse 27? Verse 27. Let me go back and look. Maybe it's a... okay, I'm looking at a Hebrew numbering, and it may be off, an offering made by fire. 4 out of the 5 offerings. Okay, I don't see an offering in my verse 27, and I'm looking a couple verses forward and back. Oh, bring an offering made by fire unto Yahuwah. I see what she's asking. Okay, you shall bring an offering made by fire. Yeah, interesting, isn't it? It doesn't say specifically, and I hadn't noticed that, so that's a good point. I'll give you my initial impression, when having not studied it out and taken a look. There are several types of olah, obviously, and it might be that this is, what would you call it, dealer's choice. Bring an offering is what it seems to be saying. That would be at least my first reading, and subject to being changed. Okay. So I don't know if that's a good answer or not. It's the best answer I've got without doing a little bit more study on that one. I'm sure there is a traditional understanding, but I'm not sure what that is. Okay. And is it a sin offering or a guilt offering? And the answer is it doesn't say there either. It's just an offering made by fire. So it's an olah by definition, because that's what it means to be lifted up by fire. But it doesn't sound like it's either of those. It is an offering, however, which is associated with this idea of, in this case, it would be the day of trumpets or Yom Teruah, day of shouting. Okay. He continues. Now speak unto the children of Israel. Say this on the 15th day of the seventh month. So we've had the first day, Yom Teruah. We blow the shofar. Countdown starts. 10th day is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And 5 days later, on the 15th day of the seventh month, is the Feast of Tabernacles. This is going to be a full 7-day feast, it says, unto Yahuwah. On the first day, and as it turns out on the last day, is to be a holy convocation, no manner of servile work. So we're back to, again, the idea of a cooking feast, whatever that means. And not as not nearly as strict of a requirement as either on the weekly Sabbath or especially on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. But it's 7 days that you shall bring an offering made by fire, that is, if you had a place to bring it, to Yahuwah. 8th day is a holy convocation unto you. Bring an offering made by fire unto Yahuwah. It is a day of solemn assembly. You shall do no manner of servile work. Now, what's interesting to me about this, we're going to get some more description about this week. And, of course, we know that this is going to be the time of the final of the feasts of the year, the time of Sukkot. Says this, these are the appointed seasons of Yahuwah, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations. Bring an offering made by fire unto Yahuwah, burnt offering and a meal offering, a sacrifice and zebak, I'm pretty sure. Let me see. Yep, that's the word that's used there. And drink offerings, each on its own day. Besides the regular Sabbaths of Yahuwah, and besides your gifts, and besides all your vows, and besides all your free will offerings, which you give unto him. So this is additional stuff. Howbeit, on the 15th day of the seventh month, when you have gathered in the fruits of the land, you shall keep the feast of Yahuwah 7 days. The first day, solemn rest. 8th day, solemn rest. And you're going to take with you the first day, the fruit of goodly trees. Now here comes the four species. This is where at least the tradition comes from of these four species. And there's a whole lot that that is said to go with this. The translations are interesting, right? The lulav and the let me look in the Hebrew here. I'm drawing a blank on the other. The etrog, that's the other one I was trying to think of. There it is. So, fruit of goodly trees, branches of palm trees, boughs of thick trees, willows of the brook. And here is the key. You shall rejoice. I love this word. Samach. Sameach. Ever heard that term? Hag Sameach. A joyful feast. The root word there is to rejoice. This is a joyful time. Rejoice before Yahuwah for 7 days. One more comment I will make. I would suggest a virtual lead pipe cinch. You can prove it a whole bunch of ways from Scripture, but it simply makes sense from the standpoint, if you read the rejoicing part, if you read the understanding, if you look at the first day and the eighth day and so forth, all the pieces fit. It does seem like it's a pretty good bet, in other words. Not an ironclad proof, mind you, but I tend to believe that, with a 99% certainty anyway, Yahushua was born during this time. Certainly during the fall feasts, and probably, my take would be, probably on the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles or Sukkot. There are others that would say, no, he was probably born 15 days earlier or thereabouts at Yom Teruah. But in any case, if he was born on the first day and circumcised on the eighth day, all of that part fits. But I do like the idea of the joyfulness here. And of course, we also know that the symbolism of this feast has to do with the wedding feast as well, which is a consistent metaphor that appears throughout, especially the teachings of Yahushua and the various prophecies. You shall keep this feast. It's a statute forever in your generations. You shall keep it in the seventh month. And furthermore, it says you're to dwell in booths. In, right? What's a booth? A sukkah? Sukkot, plural. You shall dwell in Sukkot, Bay Sukkot, for 7 days. All that are homeborn in Israel shall dwell in booths. It's a reminder, so that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel to dwell in booths when I brought them up out of the land of Mitzrayim, Ani Yahuwah Elohim. Now, I like to point this out. This word manger, you know, we got the picture that people put there. If you understand that at the time when the Feast of Ascension, this would have been when the men of Israel were going to go anyway to that area, and if people are dwelling in booths, it makes sense. All of the men of the land are coming to the vicinity of Jerusalem. They're all over the place. The hotel space is probably at a minimum, but one thing they got a lot of is booths, Sukkot, mangers. And so there is a whole lot of understanding, I will contend, that's pretty ironclad once you see it, that Yahushua was born in a sukkah. Old English word, manger. But they didn't understand it because they were ignoring the commandment that was right here says, keep forever as a statute throughout your generations. So that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel to dwell in booths when I brought them up out of the land of Egypt. He signs it, Ani Yahuwah Elohim. Well, by the time of the King James translation, they weren't keeping it, and they didn't know, and they'd forgotten. And there you go. So it says, Moshe declared to the children of Israel the appointed seasons of Yahuwah. And later on, the pagan Romans undeclared them and said, no, we got these better feasts today. We're not going to worry about what he said were my feasts. Keep them forever throughout your generations. And there's a real problem there. All right, chapter 24. This is the final chapter of the Parsha. Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, command the children of Israel, they bring pure olive oil, beaten for a light, going to burn it continually, always, at all times, outside the veil of the testimony, the tent of meeting. Aaron is to put it in order from evening to morning. So it starts at evening, and it burns to morning before Yahuwah continually. Uh-oh. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations. He orders the lamps upon the pure candlestick, the menorah, before Yahuwah continually. Now let's pause there. I guess if the temple has been destroyed and the Mishkan has been destroyed and these things don't exist anymore, he can't do it. It doesn't mean that the commandment has been done away with. It just means you can't do it. And obviously there is no high priest to do it either, right? Yes, I understand as I say that. It is, I'm sure, being done in the heavenlies, but that's a different story. You shall take the fine flour, bake 12 cakes, two tenths parts of an ephah in each cake, set them in two rows, two sets of six, upon the pure table before Yahuwah. Pour frankincense in each row as part of a bread for memorial part, an offering made by fire. Every Sabbath day he does this, sets it in order before Yahuwah continually. It is from the children of Israel an everlasting covenant. And it's for Aaron and his sons. They eat it in the set-apart place. Most holy it is of the offerings made to Yahuwah by fire, a perpetual due. Now we get a story at this point. You got the son of an Israelitish woman. His father was an Egyptian. And he went out among the children of Israel, and the son of the Israelitish woman and a man of Israel strove together in the camp. They had a fight. The son of the Israelitish woman blasphemed the name. What name? The Shem, et Hashem, literally the name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and he cursed. So they brought him before Moshe. And it tells us his mother's name was Shelomit, the daughter of Dibri of the tribe of Dan. So they put him in a ward. They held on to him so that they could figure out what to do with him at the mouth of Yahuwah. And then Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, here's what you're going to do. Bring forth him that has cursed outside the camp, and let all that heard him lay their hands upon his head. Everyone that heard the curse lay his hands upon his head, and let all of the congregation, Kol Ha'edah, stone him. And then they shall speak to the children of Israel and say the following, whosoever curses his El shall bear his sin, bear his own sin. And he that blasphemes the name of Yahuwah, he shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him, as well as the stranger, the homeborn, when he blasphemes the name Shem. Shem is just a Hebrew word for name, right? When it says Hashem, the name, we're talking about that name that is spelled Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh in the Hebrew, shall be put to death. Man that smites someone mortally, well, that's a death penalty too. He that smites a beast mortally shall make it good. So you kill somebody's cow, you owe him a cow, life for life. If a man maims his neighbor, as he has done, it is done to him. Breach for breach, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, as he has maimed a man, so shall it be rendered unto him. The concept here is called measure for measure. And that's essentially, I guess I could say that's where the idea of the balancing of the scales come from. The whole concept of justice. He that kills a beast shall make it good. He that kills a man shall be put to death. You shall have one manner of Torah, as well for the stranger as for the homeborn, for Ani Yahuwah Elohim. Now, this is the last verse in the chapter. It says, when Moshe spoke to the children of Israel, they brought forth the man that had cursed out of the camp, and they stoned him with stones. And the children of Israel did as Yahuwah commanded Moshe. It's a tough lesson, but it's a serious one. We're not in the land. At the point where they did this, remember, they weren't in the land either. Now, they did get the word directly from Yahuwah through Moshe as to what it was they were to do in this case. And the key, as the verse ends and as the portion ends, Yahuwah commanded, and as he commanded, they did. Children of Israel did as Yahuwah commanded Moshe.